she amended. She was happier. For the first time in 10 years, she looked forward to each day. And it wasn't simply because Kate was with her. Kate was part of her happiness. But so was this man. It was true that Sally had been apprehensive about coming here today. She had thought it would be awkward, being in another woman's house. She had expected to feel like a stranger, almost an interloper. Instead, she felt at home. There was nothing familiar here, no reminders of Larry or her beloved granddaughter. At best, she should feel like a visitor. But though Sally couldn't explain it, she could picture herself spending the rest of her life in this house, with this man. What would Kate think of that?
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Entertainment Weekly, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 60 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-40s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This week I'm reading from their website, as I usually do, which is EW.com. I'm starting with our first article about what to watch, and then I am continuing from last week where I was reading from a list of best TV shows from 2022, and I think I can get in some Oscar predictions for who's going to be nominated. So, in our What to Watch article, Megan is a welcome addition to the demon doll genre, and Velma fails to spook. What's worth your time in movies and TV this weekend? Entertainment Weekly's critics review the latest releases, Megan, Alert, The Pale Blue Eye, and Velma. This is by Kristen Baldwin, Darren French, and Leah Greenblatt. So these are reviews. There's a couple of these that have longer reviews, and I'll hop over to those when it's appropriate. That's going to be the case with Megan, which I'm calling it Megan. It's M3GAN. Megan review. Hello, Dolly. A tiny robot wreaks murderous havoc in Blumhouse's madcap, endlessly memed horror comedy. And this is by Leah Greenblatt. There she was all winter, the demented demon doll body-yaddy-yaddying through our dreams and our social feeds, a fitting meme for these times. That Megan in theaters on Friday, last Friday, is actually a movie feels almost like an afterthought. What further proof of concept can 100 minutes at a multiplex bring that the fruit fly loops of TikTok failed to supply? Nothing, really, though Jared Johnstone's horror comedy, hard emphasis on the second word, sustains the joke surprisingly well for most of its runtime, a scampering Blumhouse caper that turns out to be blithely self-aware, negligibly jump-scary, and mostly very fun. Allison Williams, extending her niche as the unflappable final girl muse of thrillers like Get Out and The Perfection, is Gemma, apparently a minor genius when it comes to robotics. She works for a sleek toy company somewhere near Seattle, churning out Furby-like Muppets called Perfect Pets for the masses. Though her passion project is a lifelike AI, she's christened Megan. Or, if you don't go in for kicky acronyms, Model 3 Generative Android. When her sister and brother-in-law are killed in a snowy car accident in the opening scenes, she also becomes guardian to her 9-year-old niece, Katie, played by Violet McGraw. But who has time to parent a grieving child when production deadlines loom? Her cocksure boss, played by Ronnie Ching, is on her back, demanding a cheaper model of pet to undercut the company's competitors. What he gets instead is Megan, a remarkably lifelike little girl designed to serve as a companion and best friend to whoever can afford her. He's concerned at first about cost, more or less than a Tesla, but sufficiently seduced by the possibilities and the pinwheel dollar signs in his eyes to give it a green light. And what better beta tester could there be for this small miracle of biotechnology than Gemma's own traumatized niece? Megan bonds with her young charge immediately, as she's explicitly designed to do, an emotional support animal forged from wigs, silicone, and ones and zeros. She reads bedtime stories in every character's voice, provides motherly bathroom discipline, and seems to have an endless supply of Wikipedia fun facts. She is also, it turns out, unfailingly loyal, less like a lapdog than a 4-foot mafioso. And when various outsiders interfere, a meddling neighbor, a nasty classmate, any misguided human who attempts to hit her power switch, Megan's reflex response is homicide. It's entertaining and not particularly bloody to watch her cut a swath, sometimes literally, through various set pieces and soft tissues, preening and dropping pithy one-liners with as much hair-flipping malevolence as any star of Selling Sunset. Director Johnstone, a native New Zealander, moves breezily through a Kayla Cooper's smartly streamlined screenplay. The story is by nouveau horror god James Wan, often turning his cameras away from the gore we're braced for and moving on briskly to the next scene. The doll designed by Satan is hardly a new concept even for Wan, the man who gave us several Annabelles, and the narrative arc, too, is almost comfortingly familiar. You know who's marked for death as soon as they walk on screen. Rest in pieces, bully boy. But the tart in-jokes and absurdities of the script, its winky acknowledgments of all the tropes gone before it, feel like a delirious cap on recent genre hits like Barbarian and Malignant. This is not the morose, carnage-soaked horror of dank basements and clammy night terrors. Most of the movie happens in bright daylight. Every maniacal head tilt, ungodly hip swivel, and murder by gardening tool calibrated for screams that end not with a gasp, but a giggle. Megan came to play and possibly reboot her motherboard for a sequel. Are you not entertained? Leah Greenblatt is rating Megan a B. Alert is our next one, and this is on television. Scott Kahn was built for procedural TV. Square-jawed and handsome, the former Hawaii Five-0 star fuses a steely, saving-the-world countenance with a flip, wiseacre charm that automatically makes him the most interesting character in every scene. Those qualities are put to capable use in Alert, Missing Persons Unit, an above-average case-of-the-week thriller that should fit in nicely with Fox's lineup of crisis responder dramas. 6 years after their son went missing, private security contractor Jason Grant, played by Kahn, and police officer Nikki Batista, played by Once Upon a Time's Dania Ramirez, are amicably separated and trying to move on with their lives. At least Nikki is. She's now head of Philly's PD's Missing Persons Unit and in a committed relationship with fellow MPU agent Mike, played by Ryan Broussard. Jason, meanwhile, is faking orgasms because he can't bear to tell his girlfriend, played by Brie Blair, that he's not ready to have another child. This is a running joke in the first two episodes. You're not on CBS anymore, Scotty. But when Jason learns that his boy may still be alive, he joins forces with Nikki and the MPU to find him and bring his kidnapper to justice. The MPU characters are all variations on templates from the procedural playbook. Mike is the stable, nice guy. C, played by Petey Gibson, is the bespectacled, persnickety, forensic anthropologist. And Kimi, played by Adeola Roy, is the brilliant and eccentric analyst who lights a lot of incense and talks frequently about her past lives. Showrunner John Isendrath from The Blacklist keeps the time is running out tension humming while managing efficient detours into the characters' personal lives and weaving in an ongoing mystery about Jason and Nikki's long-lost son. As Nikki, Ramirez offers a stalwart, no-nonsense balance to Jason's off-kilter energy, and she handles a showy stunt sequence in that premiere nicely. And Khan, reliably, is the everything bagel seasoning that keeps Alert from being just another bland lump of procedural dough. Kristen Baldwin is rating Alert a B. The Pale Blue Eye is on Netflix now. Has Christian Bale ever met a dark horse he couldn't sell? Filmmaker Scott Cooper and his actor Muse have now made 3 movies together over the last decade, all variations on a theme, or 2 themes really, blood vengeance and tortured masculinity. The Pale Blue Eye, which follows their contemporary Rust Belt noir, Out of the Furnace, and 2017's brutal frontier epic Hostiles, has all the signposts of another Cooper Bale special. Bruised knuckles and battered psyches, death without mercy, and even less levity. The parched and wintry Pale duly delivers all of that with frostbite. The cinematography is grimly gorgeous, and the austere, brooding atmosphere threaded with old-timey dread. But it also has a bright skein of offbeat whimsy running through it, thanks in part to a delightfully unbound performance by Harry Melling from The Old Guard, who nearly turns the movie into a weird and tender buddy comedy with Bale before it all surrenders to deep purple melodrama in the last act. To be fair, purple is pretty much the baseline for a film in which young men keep turning up ritualistically dead, particularly when one of their peers, played by Milling, is the godfather of goth himself, Edgar Allan Poe. His Poe doesn't yet look capable of growing a mustache when we first meet him as a young cadet at circa 1830s West Point, a cheerful outcast with a fluty southern drawl and seemingly no natural aptitude for military life. Edgar isn't a direct witness when a classmate is discovered hanging from a tree one cold morning with his heart surgically removed from his chest, but he has a lot of fanciful theories he's eager to share with Bale's Augustus Landor, the flinty veteran detective summoned from New York City to investigate. Gillian Anderson, vibrating on high, and Bohemian Rhapsody's Lucy Boynton also co-star in elaborate hoopskirts. Cooper, working from the best-selling 2003 novel of the same name by Lewis Bayard, builds a solid murder mystery out of Victorian scheming and icebox ambience. Rarely has an entire cast looked so genuinely in need of heating pads. Until he loses his way in the cascading absurdity of the final twists, though, the movie is mostly a study in how good its 2 main actors can be. Bale's soulful, hollow-eyed conviction and his odd couple chemistry with Melling isn't quite enough to sell the Pale Blue Eye's loopy improbabilities in the end, but it's still a pleasure to watch them try. Leah Greenblatt is rating The Pale Blue Eye a B. And our last one I have a full review for, it's Velma. A promising reinvention is wasted on lame jokes, prequelitis, and bad meta. Mindy Kaling's HBO Max reboot makes Harley Quinn look, well, much better than Velma. This is by Darren French. The Scooby-Doo magic is how something so bland is also so weird. A doofus, a smarty, 2 boring beauties and a talking dog drive to dark places in a bright van. Every week they find out a monster is just some guy scaring people away from his farm or family-run circus or defunct zoo or haunted hat factory. You could say the original series backwashed 60s counterculture into the American Gothic tradition with meddling kids easy riding around ghastly swamp water olds. Come on, though. Hanna-Barbera was just having a laugh on a deadline. Still, Velma dares to ask a big, dumb question. What if the Scooby gang were meta-jerks who want a bone? This is my origin story, says Velma, voiced by producer Mindy Kaling, at the start of the HBO Max reboot. The series flashes back to the high school prehistory of the greatest team of spooky mystery solvers ever, when they variously hated or barely acknowledged each other. It's a prequel that recasts diversely, reorients sexually, and over backstories generally. Should be fun, but it's self-aware slog. Everyone talks like a TV writer who only knows TV writers. The nonstop references are nonstop ancient. Jill Stein, she's all that. The suspicious assertion that band geeks being weird equals comedy gold. This is exactly what happened in my vlog about Lil Wayne, someone shouts on TV in 2023. Velma is the new Bland, a deconstructed canonical bonanza pulled right off the corporate assembly line. It's so extra, it's minus. At Crystal Cove High School, Daphne, voiced by Constance Wu, is a popular mean girl orphan who deals drugs because of a dark family secret. Her boyfriend Fred, voiced by Glenn Howerton, personifies mediocre white richness. His mansion holds a dark secret, and he has a teeny whittle privates, a subject of much conversation. Shaggy has become Norville, played by Sam Richardson, a school newspaper striver friend-zoned by his beloved Velma. He worries he's a beta male. Remember that lame humor concept from 20 years ago? In my possibly foggy recollection, Velma was the only one mentally equipped to actually solve crimes, unless Scooby pratfalled into the Rillin's Recrit Red Quarters. That would be Villain's Secret Headquarters, but in Scooby Talk. For now, this reboot is dogless. Now Velma is a misfit searching for her disappeared mother and investigating a maniac cutting girls' heads open. She exemplifies Kaling's brainy, thirsty persona, complaining about the patriarchal male gaze in the same episode where she has to subvert her best instincts to beg attractive classmates to muster all your sexiness and lure everyone away with a sexy dance. A savvy kid investigates strange doings in a shadow town full of family secrets. Sounds like Riverdale for anyone who doesn't remember Veronica Mars. Hot Archie certainly looms over any mature riff on toddler-safe pop culture. In the 8 episodes made available from the 10-part debut season, Velma gradually uncovers serialized clues while teen dramedy swirls around her. Her one-time bestie, Daphne, is her high school nemesis, though their dynamic evolves quickly before fading into the background. Some suspects are too suspicious too early. Velma keeps seeing a demonic hallucination, an enigma so nonsensical the show can only make jokes about its nonsensicality. Some animated reboots honor their foundation by improving it. Think Netflix's She-Ra and the Princesses of Power, which Tolkienized an 80s toy line tie-in into a glittery, cosmo-queer, every-genre-ever saga. Velma settles for winky nods. There's no world where I'm ever solving a mystery in an abandoned amusement park, Daphne promises, while Velma wonders, who would ever stop to put on a costume in the middle of a chase? Cheap shots, but hey, some reboots should dumb shame their predecessors. Recall how C-Lab 2021 used a forgotten Hanna-Barbera boar fest as a toilet bowl for brain-bursting absurdity. But Velma mostly replaces the old silly sensibility with crass name-dropping pointlessness. Adopted by two moms, Daphne declares she was baptized on the set of Ellen. A eulogy for the latest attractive victim notes how she was the rare slut that did not deserve to be murdered. Jesus Christ. Velma is not white, obs, nor is she straight, which caused much excitement online. A key subplot is a bit deflating on that front, though less She-Ra and Catra are dancing than Alex kisses Marissa and Seth. Obviously, anyone upset about these identity shifts is the worst, but beyond the conceptual wow of half-century-old characters suddenly having definable traits, Velma plays out like any other prequel. Learn the secret origin of Velma's glasses. Learn the secret origin of why Velma says jinkies. The few fun ideas get buried under referential shenanigans. Sam Richardson nails Sweetheart Desperation in Norville, though I'm still unconvinced the Shaggy archetype is anything more than Scoob screeched out loud. Nasty humor can work even when it's a quarter funny. So God help me, I laughed at Fred inviting a potential romantic conquest to hand-stuff point. And Daphne's moms are married cops voiced by Jane Lynch and Wanda Sykes. Why can't that be a show and not some franchise extension's J-plot? Normally, origin stories are about tall, handsome guys struggling with a burden of being handed even more power, Velma narrates. And if they're about girls, it's usually like, hey, what made this hot chick go crazy? Look, male origins are terrible, end them all. But also, rude to Black Widow, Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel, Rey, and most Catwomen. We're nowhere near origin equity, but it's a mark much missed to say female backstories are only crazy hotness. I think the joke's main target is a certain clown princess voiced elsewhere on HBO Max by Kaley Cuoco. Harley Quinn is surely Velma's ultra-violent femme-slash-touchstone, but that great cartoon is crazy with purpose. Batman drowned a while ago in a molten core of self-serious ponderousness wrapped in a candy shell of male grievance. It means something to reorbit Gotham around funny bisexual supervillain girlfriends. Whereas you get the feeling Kaling and Velma showrunner Charlie Grandy could have wedged any inoffensive IP into their way-too-late parody of teen dramas. In the words of the philosopher, ruh-roh. This is rated a C by Darren French. That's Velma. So those were our what-to-watch items for this week. Megan was a welcome addition to the demon doll genre, and Velma failed to spook. It was by Kristen Baldwin, Darren French, and Leah Greenblatt. I'm coming back to our article that we were reading last week, the 18 best TV shows of 2022 and the 5 worst. This is by Kristen Baldwin and Darren French. And we learned about Darren's list last week, and we're just about to get to Kristen's. Darren's list, I won't read the whole thing, but it was number 10 was Genius, a Kanye trilogy on Netflix. Number 9 was The Bear on FX. Number 8, Below Deck, Sailing Yacht on Bravo. Number 7, This Fool on Hulu. 6, Evil on Paramount Plus. 5, Players, also on Paramount Plus. Number 4 was Barry on HBO. Number 3, We Own This City, also on HBO. Number 2, Jendi Tartakovsky's Primal on Adult Swim. And number 1, Better Call Saul on AMC. So let's take a look at Kristen's list. Number 10, Reboot on Hulu. Too many good TV shows about TV shows are short-lived. Gross Point, Sports Night, The Comeback, Beverly Hills, 90210. As of this writing, Hulu has yet to renew Reboot, a hilarious show-within-a-show satire for a second season, so allow me to plead for its survival. created by Steve Levitan from Modern Family, Reboot follows the cast and creators of the cheesy 2000s comedy Step Right Up. Wannabe serious actor Ree, played by Keegan-Michael Key, insecure Bree, played by Judy Greer, newly sober Clay, played by Johnny Knoxville, and sheltered former child star Zach, played by Callum Worthy, who reunite to make an updated version for Hulu. Though the pitch came from indie filmmaker Hannah, played by Rachel Bloom, who wants to give the series a darker spin, the streamer pairs her with a veteran showrunner, Gordon, played by Paul Reiser, who happens to be her estranged father. Like most shows about the TV biz, Reboot shows no mercy to the industry it's exploring. You're looking at the guy who greenlit the fifth season of The Handmaid's Tale, boasts one exec when Hannah suggests her idea might be too edgy for him. But it also wields the tropes it lampoons to produce heartfelt, character-driven comedy. Come on, Hulu, where's the renewal? Lock Reboot down now, and I'll forgive you for that regrettable rehash, How I Met Your Father. Number 9, Severance on Apple TV. It began as a moody, atmospheric, borderline draggy sci-fi drama about grief and the religion of capitalism. It ended with the best season finale of the year, a thrilling, suspenseful feat of race-against-the-clock agony. In between, Severance, about a group of Lumen Industries employees who have had their personal memories surgically severed from their workplace memories, constructed two distinct worlds filled with characters who just want to put their shattered lives back together. The lightly comic, fully tragic underdog adventures of Mark, played by Adam Scott, Helly, played by Britt Lower, Dylan, played by Zach Cherry, and Irving, played by John Turturro, blended stylized workplace drudgery with twisty mystery, Baroque art with a waffle party straight out of American Horror Story, and creeping menace with poignant romance. Was there a sweeter TV couple this year than Turturro's Irv and Christopher Walken's Bert? Let us thank Keir for this freaky fable, which reminds us that even the most powerful corporations are no match for the human heart. Number 8, Los Espookies on HBO. Tati, played by Ana Fabrega, believes she's a famous novelist, even though all she's written are leaflet-length bastardizations of classic works like Don Quixote and 100 Years of Solitude. After a group of female authors explained to her the difference between writing and transcribing, it finally clicks. I understand, she says. Respect is earned, not stolen. Andres, played by Julio Torres, keeps taking advantage of his friend The Moon, played by Roma's Yalitza Aparicio Martinez, asking for favors when he loses something in the dark. Can you just go full for a second? And failing to introduce her to that famous comet like he promised. Seeing the hurt on the moon's face, he's overcome with guilt and offers her his dangly silver earring, which she's always admired. I can't keep being selfish, he sighs. The world of Los Espookies is bizarre and fantastical, but the heart behind it is 100% real. The second and final sniff season of this singular bilingual comedy brought another bounty of multi-layered humor and earnest emotion, plus a priceless Sakura-themed sight gag. Even at its absolute weirdest, Los Espookies was scary good. Number 7, Better Things on FX. It's not an exaggeration to say that there will never be another show like Better Things. The unique vision of writer-director star Pamela Adlon, Better Things was both the extremely specific story of Sam Fox, played by Adlon, a middle-aged actress and voiceover artist and single mom living in Los Angeles, and an intensely relatable exploration of modern womanhood. The fifth and final season finds Sam thinking a lot about her personal history, creeping on her childhood home, learning about her Jewish ancestors, because she's afraid of what's ahead. The meanest thing that can ever happen to you is your kids grow up, she laments. but as her children, Max, played by Mikey Madison, Frankie, played by Hannah Riley, and Duke, played by Olivia Fox, build their own lives, and her maddening mother, Phil, played by Celia Imrie, starts a new chapter overseas, Sam finds her way to an epiphany. Life doesn't end when the nest is empty. I like where I am, she marvels. I'm just realizing this right now. Better Things was masterful at finding glints of beauty in the day-to-day mundane and magic in the drudgery of motherhood. We will never have another show like it, but I'm profoundly grateful that we had it at all. Hacks is on HBO Max. Read it to me. Those four words delivered with chilling quietude prefaced the most emotionally devastating scenes in Hacks to date. After her impetuous writing partner, Ava, played by Hannah Einbinder, confesses to sending a drunken, vitriol-fueled email about her to some TV producers, famed comedian Deborah Vance, played by Jean Smart, demands to hear it in full. The letter is vicious. Deborah Vance is a bully and the worst kind, one who thinks she's a victim. But the truth hurts for a reason. In its lively and touching second season, Hacks took Deborah's show on the road while taking its central duo to gratifying new levels of introspection. Meanwhile, we were treated to more time with the magnificent ensemble, including Deborah's tightly wound manager, Jimmy, played by co-creator Paul W. Downs, and his hilariously checked-out assistant, Kayla, played by Meg Stalter, who spin workplace toxicity into comedy gold. Though the season ended on a heartbreaking goodbye between Deborah and Ava, Hacks will be back, and it's a delight to know these two aren't done telling each other brutal truths. Next, it's number 5, and I know you're curious to hear what that is, but I'll stop here to remind everybody that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, EW.com, and I'm reading an article about a 2022 article about the best TV shows from 2022, and also we'll get to hear about some of the worst. Number 5 from Kristen Baldwin is The Good Fight on Paramount Plus. Democracy is beginning to boil like the proverbial frog in the final season of The Good Fight, Robert and Michelle King's wildly funny and prescient satire about these uncertain times. If we'd all just drop our political buffs and talk to each other about reality shows, muses Liz Reddick, played by Audra McDonald, then maybe we'd, but this is no time for optimism. Rioters, the Proud Boys, Antifa, are clashing outside her Chicago law offices, and someone just threw a hand grenade into the firm's elevator. I used to believe in progress, frets Diane Lockhart, played by Christine Baranski. But here we are, Roe v. Wade, voting rights, like the last 50 years never happened. For Diane, there are only two options, stay and keep fighting or walk away from the law, the country, even her Republican husband, Kurt, played by Gary Cole. Season 6 expanded the stellar cast, Andre Braugher as Liz's visionary new partner, Richard Lane, John Slattery as Diane's dreamy doctor, Lyle Betancourt, and delivered the reality-adjacent drama we've come to expect. A billionaire, played by John Benjamin Hickey, tries to buy the Democratic Party. A well-funded group of black activists begins shipping white supremacists to Antarctica. In the finale, Liz gives Diane a pep talk for the ages. Things can always get shittier. No series has understood our country more. Number 4, Better Call Saul on AMC. Go ahead, spill your guts. Put on your hair shirt. See what it gets you. Shouting down the line at Kim Wexler, played by Rhea Seehorn, Jimmy McGill, played by Bob Odenkirk, thinks he can scold his estranged ex-wife to ignoring her conscience. But Kim takes his sarcastic advice, confessing to her role in the death of Howard Hamlin, played by Patrick Fabian. And what does it get her? Freedom. Not from her self-made prison of suburban Florida hell, with all its mid-century modern miracle whip misery, but from years of shame and slipping Jimmy a bedded ethical rot. The torment leaves her body like demons at an exorcism as she rides a city bus. Better Call Saul was already the best TV prequel ever made. In its final four episodes, the series morphed into an impeccable epilogue, giving its soul-broken central couple the comeuppance and catharsis they so desperately needed. Number three is Barry. And this is a crossover. Better Call Saul was a crossover from Darren's list, and so is Barry at number three on HBO. The beauty of Barry is in its contradictions. As Fuchs, played by Stephen Root, sent a vengeance army of grieving families after Barry, played by Bill Hader, the hitman comedy became unfathomably bleak. Julie, played by Annabeth Gish, in a haunting turn, accidentally shoots her son. Kyle, played by Alex McNichol, as they wait to ambush the man who made her a widow. Sally, played by Sarah Goldberg, fierce and fantastic, loses her first taste of TV stardom and descends into a morass of resentment and rage, ultimately beating an attacker to death with a bat. An imprisoned no-ho Hank, played by the inimitable Anthony Carrigan, is forced to listen as his friends are devoured by a wild animal in the next cell. But somehow, season three of Barry was also one of the funniest shows of the year. Think of Barry's call with customer service for a bomb app. My app isn't syncing with the Bluetooth on the device I'm trying to detonate? The stoner wisdom of Mitch, played by Tom Allen, the beignet guy. Sally's meeting with a TV exec, played by Vanessa Bayer, that mostly consists of goofy noises. We're looking for less A and more A. It's said that comedy equals tragedy plus time, but on Barry, they coexist brilliantly. Number two, Reservation Dogs, that's on FX on Hulu. The pack is in danger of splitting up in season two of this ingenious indigenous comedy. Oklahoma Teens Bear, played by DeFerro Wunate, Willie Jack, played by Paulina Alexis, Alora, played by DeVary Jacobs, and Cheese, played by Lane Factor, are growing up, but they're also starting to drift apart. Maybe it's because being together without their fifth res dog, dearly departed shit-ass Daniel, played by Dalton Kramer, just hurts too much. Or maybe that curse Willie Jack put on their rival, Jackie, played by Elva Guerra, boomeranged back on them. The transcendent sophomore outing featured wonderful spotlight episodes for the young leads. Cheese is sent to a dreary group home. Willie Jack communes with her ancestors while visiting Daniel's mom, played by Lily Gladstone, in prison. Anne gave us more of the estimable ensemble. Officer Big, played by Zane McLaren, accidentally gets dosed with psychedelics and trips his way into a white supremacist sex cult. The Aunties, played by Jenna Schmieding and Natalie Standing Cloud, Sarah Podemski and Tamara Podemski, spend a bacchanalian weekend at the Indian Health Services Conference. And Dallas Goldtooth drops in and out of a comedy tornado as Spirit Bear's glib guide from the other realm. Listen up, little effer. I'm trying to give you some ancestor teachings here. Heyo, you have our attention. And number one, Pachinko on Apple TV. Every night, Musasu, played by Soji Arai, adjusts the nails on the machines at his pachinko arcade. Everyone does it, he says, tapping the pins on the game, a sort of vertical pinball machine with a hammer, making it harder for players to guide the ball where they want it to go. Most people think if they can flick the handle just right, they will win. But they have no control over the outcome. Not really. The game of life is similarly rigged against the sprawling cast of Korean characters in Pachinko. Soo Hyun's exquisite adaptation of Min Jin Lee's bestseller. But they never stop playing to win. At the center of it all is Mosasu's mother, Sunja, played by Min-ha Kim in a breathtaking performance, whose life in a Korean fishing village in 1924 is upended when she becomes pregnant by the wealthy Ko Hansu, played by Lee Minho, almost unbearingly dashing. Forced to emigrate to Osaka, where Koreans are viewed as less than human, Sunja, played in later years by Oscar winner Yoon Ju-jung, faces poverty, racism, and oppression with steely reserve. Over 8 time-hopping episodes, Pachinko follows several generations of Sunja's family, including her grandson Solomon, played by Jin Ha, an ambitious banker whose Japanese colleagues still treat him as an outsider as they build lives in countries that are not their own. Shamefully snubbed by the Emmys, psst, voters, there's no rule against nominating 2 Korean dramas, but blessedly renewed for a second season, Pachinko is the year's biggest triumph, odds be damned. Those were the best, so 10 of each, but there was overlap, and now we get to the worst, 5 shows here to mention. The First Lady and all prestige reenactment TV. Look, we get it. Everybody wants to win an Emmy. But this year, the industry cranked out an embarrassing number of series that existed solely as awards bait. Showtime's tiresome anthology, The First Lady, had celebrated stars, meticulously crafted costumes and wigs, and precisely nothing insightful to say about its subjects. Eleanor Roosevelt, played by Gillian Anderson, Betty Ford, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, and Michelle Obama, played by Viola Davis. Beyond recorded history is more interesting when an Oscar winner acts it out. But First was not the last offender. Inventing Anna, The Dropout, We Crashed, Joe vs. Carol, George and Tammy, and so many more, all expensive, well-made shows that had everything but a point of view. There were a few exceptions, like Angeline, a cheeky deconstruction of celebrity myth-making, and The Thing About Pam, a campy spoof of true crime TV. But most of these true life tales took the Madame Tussauds approach to storytelling. Look, isn't the resemblance uncanny? Or worse, re-traumatize their subjects without their consent. Pam and Tommy, Dahmer, Monster, and the Jeffrey Dahmer story. Please let 2023 be the year that limited series genre finds its way back to fiction. I can't handle any more truth. That was by Kristen Baldwin. Big, dumb, stupid prequels. Did you know San was a babe? And did you know that young Princess Leia hung out with Obi-Wan Kenobi? And did you know that before the Halo people went to Halo, they talked about going to Halo while doing other stupid things? Absurd money flowed into pointlessly backwards franchise extensions this year. The worst results were nigh unwatchable. See Obi-Wan Kenobi's deplorable CGI and The Rings of Power, embarrassingly transforming Galadriel, played by Morfydd Clark, into an immortal sap. All the dreck made dutiful mediocrity look more appealing, which I think explains the vast overpraise for Andor. He is so boring. And House of the Dragon. When did everyone in Westeros lose their sense of humor? It's a problem when the standout prequel of the year was Star Trek Strange New Worlds, a perfectly reasonable adventure that explicitly ignores every narrative innovation of its franchise's past few decades. That was by Darren French. The Time Traveler's Wife on HBO. A blessing, really, to find a show where nothing works. Miscast actors say funny banter that is only creepy. The time travel mechanics are overexplained yet incoherent. Everything cute is disturbing, while everything disturbing is hilarious. You'll laugh at mom's decapitation. You'll laugh at the amputated feet. That was by Darren French. In fact, the next two are also by Darren French. Westworld on HBO. Wrong to beat a dead horse, I know. But what if that dead horse spoiled all its wonderful early promise? Successfully wasted Tessa Thompson and Ariana DeBose, kept trying to make digital heaven happen, refused to stop the ridiculous resurrection twists, and featured multiple scenes about scary flies. Shoot it again, Pa. And the last one not to watch is The Terminal List on Amazon Prime Video. Okay, this Seal Corps revenge fantasy isn't worse than any of the other dadly action extravaganzas certain streaming services keep producing, but I can't think of a more complete waste of star power than Chris Pratt's lead role as a Navy badass carving a bloody swath across foes corporate and political. The actor himself was an executive producer, which means even he doesn't realize how much himself he's missing here. The old throwaway charm is completely gone, replaced by sub-Eastwood squints and unconvincing flexes of beefy sorrow. So again, that was by Darren French, and that was our final update to the 18 best shows of 2022 and 5 worst. Many of those are on streaming, so we can still check those out. In the time we have left, let's take a look at the 2023 Oscar predictions. We're going to see top contenders for Academy Awards nominations. These are Entertainment Weekly's list of 2023 Oscar predictions ahead of the January 24th nominations, from Everything Everywhere All at Once to Brendan Fraser and Angela Bassett. This is by Joey Nolfi. From Hollywood Titans, Steven Spielberg, James Cameron, to first-time nominees, Brendan Fraser, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Michelle Yeoh, Entertainment Weekly's 2023 Oscar predictions features one of the most exciting crops of potential honorees in recent memory. Ahead of the 95th Academy Awards, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel, we're going to read on for the list of 2023 Oscar predictions in the Big Six categories. This will get updated as the season changes, so this is the latest entry. For Best Picture, they're predicting Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Fabelmans, Babylon, Tar, Top Gun Maverick, The Banshees of Inisherin, Avatar, The Way of Water, Elvis, Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, and Triangle of Sadness. Mainstays abound in the Best Picture race, and the first 9 contenders here have all stayed the course so far. From the crowd-pleasing Hollywood dreamscape of The Fabelmans, The Safest Bet of the Bunch, to the global box office smash Top Gun Maverick, to the celebrity spectacle Glass Onion, an acting masterclass that has a firm hold on the Academy's largest branch. Each of these contenders represents a different vital sector of the business. While The Fabelmans hits the sentimental soft spots, the film's success has largely ridden on the project's emotional impact as a semi-autobiographical story inspired by director Steven Spielberg's life. Such a singular stamp will be enough to score the filmmaking veteran a Best Director victory, but passionate, organic support for Everything Everywhere All at Once has not only sustained, but greatly intensified since the film's early 2022 release. Hollywood respects Spielberg, but they seem to be more excited by the merits of Everything on their own. With the category set at a hard 10 for the second consecutive year, the battle for the final slot is still a contentious one. Of the many, many potential nominees, from The Woman King to Black Panther Wakanda Forever, Ruben Östlund's high-class social satire Triangle of Sadness feels the timeliest, with a self-skewering message of contemporary excess that might guilt Oscar voters into ticking it higher on their ballot rankings. For Best Director, we have 5 here: Steven Spielberg for The Fabelmans, James Cameron, Avatar, The Way of Water, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert for Everything Everywhere All at Once, Jamie and Chazelle for Babylon, and S.S. Rajamouli for that's RRR. It's difficult to believe that there's an overdue narrative surrounding 3-time Oscar-winning director Steven Spielberg, perhaps the most famous and successful filmmaker alive this season, almost as difficult as it is to accept that the Academy has only recognized him, 3 times for his illustrious career. Rarely has his position felt more assured than it does for his work on The Fabelmans, a self-reflective, semi-autobiographical masterpiece about his formative years as a young man and movie-making machine that's both an easy sit for audiences and a heavily referential meta deep dive into Hollywood. While the Academy's directing set typically nominate a majority of filmmakers behind Best Picture nominees, it's not uncommon for them to go rogue, honoring the unexpected international or art house contender as well. Think David Lynch for Mulholland Drive or Paweł Pawlikowski for Cold War. This year, Indian blockbuster feels like an international hit that's too big of an achievement for the director's branch to ignore, even if it's at the expense of the voices responsible for films with more big picture heat, like Todd Field from Tar or Martin McDonagh from Banshees of Inisherin. For Best Actor, Colin Farrell from The Banshees of Inisherin, Austin Butler for Elvis, Bill Nighy for Living, Brendan Fraser for The Whale, and Paul Mescal for Aftersun. Typically, Best Actor carries heavyweight contenders primarily lifted from Best Picture contenders. This year's race feels less momentous than it has in the past, with only two of our predicted nominees likely appearing elsewhere in the Academy's top competitive category. The Banshees of Inisherin star Colin Farrell has the track record of a frontrunner, hitting virtually every major precursor so far, which began at Venice, where he won the Volpe Cup, with Austin Butler also checking all the right boxes for his portrayal of a real-life entertainment legend in Baz Luhrmann's Elvis biopic. Projecting who will round out the category is a tougher feat. Yes, Brendan Fraser for The Whale has earned career-best recognition for his transformative work as a 600-pound recluse in Darren Aronofsky's drama, but the film itself has fallen flat with the industry so far. Neither the film's script nor stellar supporting actress Hong Chau have made noise on the circuit. It could also be that Fraser's nostalgia train picked up steam too fast, too early, and the fatigued industry could coalesce around other contenders. As we saw with Glenn Close and The Wife, how the industry feels about a movie overall matters when it comes to casting ballots, and that could hurt Fraser in the end. For Best Actress, it's Cate Blanchett in Tar, Michelle Yeoh in Everything Everywhere All at Once, Michelle Williams in The Fabelmans, Viola Davis in The Woman King, and Margot Robbie in Babylon. Sorry to this category of fabulous women, but the Best Actress race is currently and has long been a tight matchup between Cate Blanchett in Tar and Michelle Yeoh in Everything Everywhere All at Once. Statistically, they're almost deadlocked on the precursor front for their respective work in major Best Picture contenders. Most of this year's contending ladies appear in likely top-tier nominees, though Blanchett's victory at Venice gives her a razor-thin edge for now. Still, Everything Everywhere is picking up major heat, and Yeoh could soon to overtake Blanchett, especially when SAG announces its list of nods, which will probably include the sci-fi hits cast among the ensemble honorees. For Best Supporting Actor, Ki-Hoo Kwan from Everything Everywhere All at Once, Brendan Gleeson from The Banshees of Inisherin, Paul Dano in The Fabelmans, and Judd Hirsch in The Fabelmans, and Barry Keoghan in Banshees of Inisherin. It took nearly four decades, but Goonies and Indiana Jones star Ki-Hui Kwan bided his time, taking a lengthy break from the screen to return at, well, the right time to score his first Oscar nomination. Praise for the beloved actor has yet to subside since Everything Everywhere debuted at the first half of 2022 and carried through to ballots on the precursor trail so far. If he secures a nod, all report card stats suggest as much at least right now, his journey from the film's March release through to the 95th Academy Awards will have been a one-year affair, and it's the kind of passion that doesn't just stop at nomination. And for Best Supporting Actress, Jamie Lee Curtis, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Carrie Condon in The Banshees of Inisherin, Angela Bassett, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Janelle Monáe in Glass Onion and Knives Out Mystery, and Nina Haas in Tar. Jamie Lee Curtis has never been nominated for an Oscar. It might take a moment for that to sink in, but precursor voters have wasted no time bolstering the actress's bid for her debut nod for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. On the rise behind her, though, is Angela Bassett, the scene-stealing heart and soul of Marvel's blockbuster sequel, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. The rare acting contender from a global tentpole that captured more than just audience dollars. Those are our 2023 Oscar predictions so far, and it's an ever-changing list, although it seems like it's pretty stable now. I got through that pretty fast. Here's a quick bit from James Cameron saying he can't wiggle out of making more Avatar sequels after box office success. It looks like, just with the momentum that the film has now, that we'll easily pass our break-even in the next few days, the director said. This is by Nick Romano. Well, it looks like James Cameron has to go through with his promise to make all those other Avatar movies. In a new interview with CNN anchor Chris Wallace for Who's Asking Chris Wallace, the director says Avatar: The Way of Water is doing so well at the box office that it appears the future of the franchise is set, despite shedding some realistic doubt about it in the past. It looks like, just with the momentum that the film has now, that we'll easily pass our break-even in the next few days, actually, Cameron tells Wallace in an interview that's now available on HBO Max and is also available on CNN. So it looks like I can't wiggle out of this. I'm going to have to do these other sequels. I'm sure that we'll have a discussion soon with the top folks at Disney about the game plan going forward for Avatar 3, which is already in the can, he continues. We've already captured and photographed the whole film, and then Avatar 4 and 5 are both written. We even have some of 4 in the can, so I think that we can see, I think, that we've begun a franchise at this point. Disney had previously set 4 sequels to 2009's Avatar, including this year's Avatar: The Way of Water, for releases in theaters every 2 years until 2028. Cameron previously confirmed to Entertainment Weekly that he shot The Way of Water, the third film, and the first act of the fourth film simultaneously. Sometimes they would shoot scenes from multiple films on the same day. However, during the press tour for Avatar 2, Cameron said that the future of the later sequels was dependent on the success of The Way of Water in theaters. The market could be telling us we're done in 3 months, or we might be semi-done, meaning, okay, let's complete the story within movie 3 and not go on endlessly, if it's just not profitable, he told Total Film. We're in a different world now than we were when I wrote this stuff, even, he added. It's the 1-2 punch, the pandemic and streaming. Or conversely, maybe we'll remind people that going to the theater, what it's all about. This film definitely does that. The question is, how many people give an S now? Audiences definitely give an S. One day after breaking into the top 10 highest grossing films of all time worldwide, Avatar: The Way of Water became the 9th highest grossing film, surpassing 2012's The Avengers with a total of more than $1.546 billion. Wallace also asks Cameron how he would have felt unable to finish his entire story plan for Avatar. Not so bad, the filmmaker replies. I mean, look, I understand this business and I understand the vagaries of it and the variables. And you know the old expression, man proposes, God disposes. You never quite know what's going to happen. I also believe in planning for the upside. Not just making a movie herky-jerky and then waiting to see what happens, but plan for the upside and then accept that if it doesn't work. Avatar 3 is scheduled to open in theaters on December 20th, 2024, and Avatar 4 coming December 18th, 2026, Avatar 5, December 22nd, 2028. That was James Cameron saying he can't wiggle out of making more Avatar sequels, and it was by Nick Romano. And that really is all the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. Come back next week to hear what articles I've found. Thank you for listening this week. Until next time. Goodbye.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Here's what's happening on the Noon Book